Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Friday, June 17th. I'm Joyce Napier. Coming up, criminal charge.
The victim of the assault was a 10-year-old female student of Fort Alexander Residential School.
After a decade-long investigation, police charge a 92-year-old Manitoba priest accused of sexually assaulting a 10-year-old student at the Fort Alexander Residential School 50 years ago. What about other ongoing investigations? Is time running out to hold alleged abusers responsible? We take you to Manitoba. And criminal intoxication.
An individual would be held responsible for the violence they commit while in a state of extreme intoxication if they ended up in that state through their own criminal negligence.
Can the government pass brand new legislation on criminal intoxication before the House rises next week? In moments, we'll ask Justice Minister David Lametti. Plus, allegations against Assembly of First Nations National Chief Roseanne Archibald. The AFN brings in an external investigator, while Chief Archibald alleges a smear campaign. We'll bring you the latest. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. The federal government has tabled its response to the Supreme Court's extreme intoxication ruling. The new bill would create criminal liability when a violent crime is committed under what the government calls a negligent state of self-induced extreme intoxication. Now remember, last month the Supreme Court struck down a section of the criminal code that excluded intoxication as a criminal defense, unanimously ruling that extreme intoxication can be used as a defense in the case of violent crimes. That ruling sparked a fierce backlash, with many arguing it could put women and children at risk. So, will this new bill satisfy the Supreme Court? And does this mean there is no point in which someone can use extreme intoxication as a defense? Well, let's find out. Joining me now is Justice Minister David Lametti. Minister, good to have you on the show. Thanks for making the time. I imagine you're very busy today. Now, there's a lot of questions on this, because could, you know, the court ruled last month that the previous wording of that section in the criminal code was unconstitutional because it eliminated self-induced intoxication as a defense. How did you fix that?
Well, we took cues from the court itself. The court gave us a couple of avenues, potential avenues to follow. We took those cues, and what we have done is we have said that if it was reasonably foreseeable, if the risk was reasonably foreseeable that one would lose control in a state of automatism, then the entry into that state is what we're criminalizing. So it's actually the reasonable care that one takes, or the reasonable risk that one ought to have seen in entering into that state, either through drugs or alcohol or both. It still maintains a defense for someone, for example, who is following a prescription and has a completely unforeseen reaction to a medication and enters into that state. But Joyce, let me also say that these are very, very rare occurrences. There are very, very few cases of within our Canadian legal system of this state of automatism. In the day-to-day, drinking or getting high is not a defense to sexual assault, is not a defense to assault. Violent crimes, if you are drunk and you commit a violent crime, you will be found guilty. That's not a defense. It was not the case before the Supreme Court decision. It's not the case after. You are liable in those circumstances.
But there still is, you know, you can still use extreme intoxication, if I'm understanding, as a defense. You said in extreme cases. So give me an example where, because the cases that were thrown out by the Supreme Court are those were violent crimes. I mean, a man, you know, attacking a woman with a broomstick, that sounds to me quite violent. So it still can be used, you said, in extremely rare cases. Give me an example where it could be used, and where is the burden of proof then?
Well, with respect to the example, the only case where this defense can be used is where one is in some way intoxicated or high on drugs to the point of being in an automatism, a state of automatism. So you're no longer in control of your movement. And it's only in the case where you didn't reach that state negligently. So if there was any reason why you should have known, previous experience, why the risk should have been reasonably foreseeable that you would lose control of your actions, lose control of your capability to control yourself, if you want to put it that way, you will be found guilty in all of those cases. So we have covered with the law today most of the cases, most of the kinds of violent cases that people were afraid might be possible. We've only hived off one very, very small exception, which is you had no reasonable means of knowing that you would enter into that state. So the prescription drugs, for example, you're taking them for the first time, you have a reaction, it leads you to a state of automatism. It is up to the person in the proceeding to raise the defense and to give evidence that they reached that state of automatism. And then it's obviously up to the Crown to dispute that. But the burden is initially on the person to raise that state of affairs, to give evidence of that state of affairs on the balance of probabilities. And then of course the Crown can attack that. So again, it is a very restricted defense. We think though that it meets the constitutional standards set out by the court. And maintains the accountability and the confidence that people have in the justice system, in the sense that we know that virtually all cases of intoxication and extreme intoxication will lead to the person being charged with the violent act that they committed.
So basically somebody who takes a whole bunch of mushrooms and then commits, you know, horrific crimes will not be acquitted.
In it will depend on the circumstances, but in the vast majority of cases, we say yes, they will be found guilty.
Okay. I want to ask you, Minister, because the House rises next week until September and the clock is ticking now. Will you be able to get this bill through before that? And are you working with the opposition?
Confident we will be able to get it through. I'm an optimist, but we have been working with the opposition. We have had conversations from the beginning. I have signaled that we would find a path forward in the time that was remaining, and that there would be a proposed bill that we felt they could live with. We obviously didn't breach parliamentary privilege, but we have had conversations. I'm pretty confident that this bill has the kind of consensus across Canadian society, victims groups, women's groups, legal experts, and others. And there is a broad consensus across society. The opposition has expressed willingness to work with us. All of the parties in opposition have expressed willingness to work with us. So I'm pretty optimistic that both in the House and in the Senate, we can do what needs to be done with the time we have left.
And you only have 1 week left. Minister Lametti, thanks so much for taking the time. And we wish you luck on this bill, because we know that it does take some time. But before I let you go, I want to ask you something. I want to talk about a charge connected to an assault at a residential school in Manitoba, a charge that has been laid against a 92-year-old priest after a 10-year investigation. I'm wondering, is the federal government giving any First Nations support to undergo these kinds of very difficult investigations?
Well, these kinds of investigations, as you know, Joyce, are undertaken by the police. And then charges are laid in conjunction with by the police, and then the cases proceed with usually provincial prosecution services, but occasionally the federal prosecution service, and they are independent of government. They are independent of me. But that being said, I think we all want to see serious crimes be punished seriously, particularly these, because of the devastating impact that they have had. And no one should underestimate our desire, or my desire as Minister of Justice, to see these kinds of crimes investigated and prosecuted, even if they took place a long time ago.
And they are difficult indeed to investigate and to prosecute. Justice Minister David Lametti, thanks for taking the time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And coming up, Manitoba RCMP charged a 92-year-old priest accused of sexual abuse at a residential school 50 years ago. How significant is today's charge? We find out next. Keep watching Power Play. We'll be right back.
Red River Meat TV. Thank you for coming this morning. Manitoba RCMP Major Crime Services investigators arrested retired father Arthur Moss, 92 years of age, at his residence in Winnipeg on a charge of indecent assault in relation to a sexual assault that occurred more than 50 years ago.
Many other priests and clergies and nuns that need to be held accountable that may still be alive. I think it's the responsibility of police services across the country, right up to the Minister of Justice, to ensure that these files are dusted off, reinvestigated, re-interviewed, and brought forth for charges if so needed.
And welcome back. A step towards justice. A priest has been charged with indecent assault connected to a historic sexual assault against a 10-year-old girl. 92-year-old retired father Arthur Mas was arrested last night on one count dating back to an alleged incident that happened between 1968 and 1970 at the Fort Alexander Residential School. This charge was the result of a decade-long investigation that involved hundreds of people, with more than 75 witness and victim statements. So, what happens now? And with many more outstanding allegations, is time running out to hold alleged perpetrators accountable? Let's find out. And joining me now from Highway 12 in Manitoba is a Saugeen First Nations Chief Derek Henderson. Chief Henderson, welcome to Power Play. It's good to have you on the show. I wonder what your community, or how your community is reacting to these charges, or to this charge, rather.
Yeah. Well, I think it's too early to tell, right? The announcement was made this morning around 9:30, right? So, you know, in the community, it's moving forward as we go, right, daily and do our business. But, you know, we'll see how it is over the weekend and, you know, in early next week, right, some of the reaction we'll be getting. So, you know, I'm sure that it's re-traumatizing some of our community members, again, as, you know, whenever we talk about this issue of the residential schools, right?
But is there a sense in for the survivors in your community that although it did take 10 years to get to this, that there is maybe some justice? Is can we even say that?
Well, I think, you know, that, you know, whatever the results are of the investigation and now the court proceedings that'll be happening, right? That'll be the, I guess whatever that result is, will give the community that, you know, either the satisfaction or, you know, whatever you want to call it, right? But I think there is some justice, whatever we define justice by, because, you know, how many people went to that residential school, right? And all the residential schools in Canada and wherever, right? I mean, there's a lot of students that were impacted or impacted.
But yeah, exactly. To that point, Chief, you know, the investigation took a decade, involved hundreds of people to get to this. The priest in question is now, what, in his 90s? He's 92. Are you worried that time is running out to hold those people accountable?
Well, yeah, when you think about it, right? I mean, how many of those people that were working there at that time are still here today, right? You know, the individual that's been charged is 92 years old. So I don't know how many people are still living that were part of the residential school in our community. So that's a guessing game, right? I don't know. I don't have those statistics. We're going to be doing some research in our community regarding the students that went to school there. As you're probably aware of, we're doing the search in our community as we sit here today, right? So we're still doing that, and it'll continue until we figure out, you know, what has happened in our community.
So let's talk about those searches and those investigations. So what kind of support do communities need right now to continue these investigations?
Well, I think there needs to be resources, right? I know that the federal government has made some commitments, you know, to continue with the searches in our communities. I know that the provincial government of Manitoba had made an announcement the other day that they are providing $2.5 million to the residential schools in Manitoba, but that doesn't go a long ways when you have 18 residential schools that are doing, you know, that will be doing searches in Manitoba. So, you know, if you do the math, I mean, it's, you know, it's about 100,000+ per community. But, you know, when you do the searches, it's very expensive, right? Because you're bringing out a team of, you know, seven to ten people coming out every time you do a search for 7 days. So the cost is very high, right, to do all this work.
So I know there's been searching underway at Fort Alexander Residential School. That's the residential school that the RCMP investigated in this case. Can you share with us any update on the kind of work that is going on?
Well, the search team, they're called AltoMax. So what they've done is they brought out teams out to our community. They've done the they do the drone search, and then they do the ground penetrating radar on the ground, right? So what they're doing is, you know, when we had meetings with the community members, what they would do is they would come out and they would pinpoint areas around the residential school and also in different areas in the community, right? And that's where the team would then go there and they would map out and start doing the search in those areas, those specific areas that the people were telling them to go and look.
Do you think that this will inspire some of these members to come forward now?
You know, I mean, I, you know, you would hope that it's an individual that has to make that decision, right? You know, we don't, you know, you don't want to force people, and people have to be comfortable in doing that, right? Because it's not just a matter of reporting it. Then there's a lot of information that's required. You know, there's evidence, and there's just so much information, you know, to be looked at. And, you know, for this one to take 10 years, right? I mean, that's how long is the next one going to take? It's going to take 10 years? 5 years, 15 years, we don't know, right? So it all depends, I guess, on the situations.
Yeah, and it is something, Chief Derek Henderson, that we will be following for sure. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Well, you have a great day, Joyce, and thank you again.
For the Indigenous community, the pain and trauma of residential school is intergenerational. For survivors and families, there is a crisis line available 24 hours a day. That number is 1-866-925-4419. And coming up, AFN National Chief Roseanne Archibald is facing an investigation, but she says she's facing a smear campaign. So what is going on? CTV's Mackenzie Gray has the latest next. Stay with PowerPlay. And welcome back. Assembly of First Nations National Chief Roseanne Archibald is facing an investigation after the AFN says it received a number of complaints. Chief Archibald is slamming these allegations as a smear campaign. In a statement, she says, "I've been undermined, discredited, and attacked. This is the second time I've endured a smear campaign as a result of my relentless pursuit of the truth." For more, let's bring in CTV's National News parliamentary producer, Mackenzie Gray. Hi, Mackenzie. What is going on here? What can you tell us?
Well, you mentioned it off the top there, Joyce. There's an investigation. The AFN has brought in an external investigator to look into Roseanne Archibald. They said last month a number of people came forward to them, and they're not really saying too much more other than that they have complaints against Ms. Archibald, but she is really fighting back, saying that they're really, she doesn't believe that these allegations are coming forward, and she's really taken a step further too, Joyce. She said that there's corruption in the AFN, and that some of these allegations are essentially motivated by the fact that she's trying to change the AFN, and people are coming forward and pushing back against her. She's upped the ante and said that she wants a forensic audit and in another investigation into the AFN over the last 8 years to look at how the culture and what's been done at the AFN at that level. So that's the back and forth between the AFN and Ms. Archibald.
So, Mac, but what do you make of the timing of these allegations?
Well, obviously the timing is difficult for the AFN. There's a number of important Indigenous issues that are coming up right now, the biggest of which is the Pope visiting. He's coming at the end of July, and traditionally the head of the AFN would be there and be participating in it. It's important to note that Ms. Archibald will still be continuing in her role as national chief, but this certainly will be a cloud that's hanging over her too. And there's another, you know, you just talked about it earlier with your previous guest, Joyce, the potential for more charges to potentially be brought forward and other issues when it relates to residential schools. So having this hanging over Ms. Archibald is difficult, in particular when you think back to previous AFN chiefs, Phil Fontaine, Perry Bellegarde, very vocal on a lot of the shows that we have here on CTV, routinely talking with the media as well. So this could be a difficult moment for Ms. Archibald to be able to navigate the investigation as well as being able to deal with her issues as a national chief.
And we will be following this issue for sure. CTV's Mackenzie Gray, thanks for this.
Thanks, Joyce.
Now, here's some other news you need to know. Members of the World Trade Organization reached a landmark deal when it comes to the global fight against COVID-19. The WTO will partially lift the patent waiver for COVID vaccines, allowing for developing countries to produce and export vaccines. But this lifting of intellectual property protection is only temporary. It will only last 5 years and will not apply for COVID tests and treatments. And Ottawa is preparing an unprecedented security response at Canada Day celebrations this year. Following the February so-called Freedom Convoy protests, groups are planning additional Canada Day demonstrations. So concern over those protests is prompting a large police response, according to a background briefing by Police and Heritage Canada today. And coming up, inflation is forcing Canadians to pay more. So why is the government showing fiscal restraint during the current affordability crisis? Our panel of political strategists will dig into the government's inflation response next. Stay right here with Power Play.
Is new money for the Canadians receiving it this year. But these are all measures we built into our last two budgets. These are measures that have already been accounted for.
And welcome back. In the battle against inflation, the government is holding the line, as in nothing new is being put on the table. Yesterday, Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland unveiled her government's affordability plan, which was ultimately a repackaging of previously announced measures from the last two budgets. About $8.9 billion worth of supports will be rolling out to Canadians this year. Some of the measures include a boost to the Canada Workers Benefit, a 10% increase to old age security, but only for those aged 75 and older, and a one-time $500 payment to low-income workers to help with rent. The government is also touting its $10 a day childcare deals with the provinces and territories as a way to help combat rising costs. But as more and more Canadians struggle under the weight of inflation, did the government miss an opportunity to do more? Let's take this to our panel of Friday strategists. Greg McCachran from Proof Strategy in chief brings the conservative voice. Anne McGrath is the NDP's national director. And Greg Wesson from Earnscliffe Strategies has a nonpartisan perspective. Hello, Friday Strats. Always nice to see you. Thanks for being there. Greg McCachran, we're going to start with you because it's about the Liberals. So the government did not announce anything new. So was it a smart political move to repackage all announcements and all money already earmarked in past, you know, budgets as a new solution for Canadians? You know, this after the government touted this speech as their solution to inflation.
Well, I don't know what they touted it to you, Joyce. I just, you know, knew that Mr. Freeland was going to do a speech, and I think it's an important time. there's a lesson here for the liberals, too, that they've not really successfully had a huge communication win out of any budget. And so if they're going to start, you know, working harder on selling their budget, their fall economic statement, I think that's a good thing. I don't think it falls on one communication director. Every member of parliament, every staffer, you know, there are programs that they should be using to help them communicate to Canadians what they're going to do. Was it a smart political move? Yes, because the Conservatives have said that they don't want more spending, so they avoided that criticism. But the reality is it was also smart fiscal prudence as well, because I'm not sure, and based on my readings of what economists tell us, that more money right now is the solution to inflation. And we know that, you know, the Bank of Canada is going to look at addressing interest rates as a way to slow this down. What we really need to do is avoid a recession. And what we really need to do is get through the pandemic. It's still affecting us, what's going on in China. We need to end the war in Ukraine. All of these things are impacting us. So this is a really, you know, awful, perfect storm at the moment.
Indeed. But Greg Weston, so this affordability plan targets vulnerable people, seniors, working poor, low-income renters. Now, should the feds have done more to make that middle-class Canadians feel more supported, you know, during this affordability, you know, crisis? This is the government working for the middle class and those struggling to join it. Should there have been more in there for them?
Well, Joyce, here's the problem with these big numbers. As soon as you start having universal checks going out to a very large number of Canadians, you start running into some huge numbers here for not a whole lot that's going into anybody's pocket. I mean, this is $8 billion. That's a big whack of money. You do the math, that's about $200 for each Canadian. So it's not, this is not going to be a windfall for anybody. It's not going to solve the problem of inflation, of rising prices on absolutely everything. So, look, this was the government needed to be seen to be doing something. Everybody's talking about this. We're saying, you know, why didn't they do more? And the opposition says, why don't they do more? And really, they should do less, they're saying in the same breath. So they're in this jam. They have to be seen to be doing something. I think most Canadians would agree that if you're going to start somewhere, you certainly start with the Canadians who need it the most, who are in low income, and in this case, senior citizens as well. The problem is it's not going to get solved by throwing money at it. As Greg said, you know, throwing more money into the economy right now is trying to douse the fire with gasoline. It's just going to drive up inflation more. Every economist. So they're kind of stuck in a rock and a hard place. If there's one thing the Liberals did wrong, they oversold what it was they are trying to deliver to Canadians.
Absolutely. That we can say as a certainty. But Adrian, so what was your read? So she spoke to business leaders, and it's true. This was not new money, so that must be comforting to them. But the Conservatives have suggested tax cuts mm-hmm. on fuel, suspend the carbon tax for a while, give people a break at the pump. Was this well received in that crowd?
I doubt it, because like you, I agree with you that Chrystia Freeland's staff sort of sold this as the solution, the big plan. You know, even when I get the press release, I think that they're going to say something that's quite significant and not just a rehash of their previous budgets. But I mean, I think we can all agree that we're not going to be able to spend our way to prosperity. But those tangible measures that the Conservatives and others, frankly, have talked about with respect to the gas tax, with respect to the carbon tax, those are all things that Canadians can feel immediately. And I know that the Liberals, you know, sort of dubbed this as we were speaking to the most vulnerable Canadians. Well, frankly, every Canadian, perhaps save for the ultra, ultra rich, are vulnerable right now with the realities of inflation. It doesn't matter, and we have the needs versus the wants, and the needs are winning out, but people aren't able to afford them. And so these are things that those small measures like the tax reductions could help us immediately. The province of Ontario is moving ahead with the suspension of the gas tax come July 1st. So, I mean, that's not the be-all, end-all solution, Joyce, but it's certainly a measure that can give relief immediately.
And it's not throwing money at the problem, so no inflationary, action here. But and your party wants the government to go further by imposing an excess profit tax on big companies. So, you know, one question is, wouldn't these companies pass this tax on to consumers and make prices just go higher? And also, you know, companies, the private sector are the biggest employers, you know, investors, and we need investors in Canada, shy away from high tax jurisdictions. So how do you balance that?
I think a lot of Canadians, first of all, I agree, most Canadians are very preoccupied with the cost of living and are keeping a very sharp eye on it. You can't go to a grocery store or put gas in your car or try and afford where you live and worry about what's going to happen as interest rates continue to climb. You know, these are all very real, serious pressures that people are experiencing. And at the same time, we do see the largest and the richest corporations experiencing windfall profits. They are profiting off the pandemic and all of the other factors that are creating this particular economic crisis that we're in. And there is an unfairness there. And there is an ability to tax those excess profits and to redistribute that money to people who need it, people who are experiencing these pressures right now. And that is a non-inflationary, non-recessionary move. One of the things I think about, and I agree with what's been said about the minister's speech, is that it was sold as something new. And I think that it was a little bit of a reaction to the fact that there's been a bit of an empathy gap with the Liberals on the cost of living. You know, the way that they've been responding to it seems to be really kind of out of touch with what a lot of Canadians are experiencing. So this was a kind of a response to that. But then to sort of blatantly just re-announce the things from the last two budgets, again, just exacerbated this idea that they are out of touch and that they don't know what Canadians are going through, and they don't understand that Canadians do see that stark difference between the ability of the major corporations to just kind of rack up massive profits while, you know, we pay $10 extra for items at the grocery store.
But true that. But, you know, the minister did visit a hardware store before going to that speech, talked to a hardware store owner who told her that there was also supply chain issues. But there are other issues, Greg McCachran. Another pillar of the government's inflation response in that speech is investing in immigration. But the immigration backlog has ballooned to 2.4 million people. So how can the Trudeau government ease the labor supply constraints when processing immigration application is so slow?
Yeah, earlier this week, just in conversation with someone fairly senior in this government, we were talking about a local store, local bakery that is closing down. And part of the reason they're closing down is they have trouble sourcing staff, you know, what's called the Great Resignation. And this person, again, senior official in this government, said the answer to this is immigration. So now we know that they see it that way. The problem is this backlog. I would hazard a guess that Sean Fraser, the immigration minister, is very young, still fairly new in the job, will be very seized with this because, you know, I'm feeling it in my industry. Joyce, I suspect you are in the media industry. Someone, again, in government was talking about, you know, just trying to find people to work in the jobs right now. We've had a huge psychological shift during the pandemic in terms of our attitudes towards work. We're going to be dealing with this for a long time as we transition back. The reality is we have a lot of people who want to move to Canada who want to work. Let's get on that.
So, Greg Weston, so immigration is a solution, but there's a backlog. The Conservatives are saying cut the GST on fuel, suspend the carbon tax temporarily. Okay, we know they don't like it, but temporarily, you know. So is that a good step towards making people whole? And what would be so difficult for, I understand that it would be difficult to suspend the carbon tax. It's sort of the identity of the Liberals, but suspending the GST, they're raking in a lot of money. Because of the high cost of fuel, because of this inflation. So what makes it so difficult for the Liberals to suspend the tax on fuel? the GST?
Well, their argument is that the people who benefit most are upper income Canadians when you play with the gas tax, with gas prices. Secondly, there is a big stack of as you know, taxes on gas. So it's a question of how it actually change people's lives, Joyce. It hurts every time you go to the pump, but is it really a big thing every day for people? As far as the carbon tax goes, in most provinces, it is being where the federal government is concerned. Everywhere that there is a carbon tax, a federal carbon tax, that money is being refunded to people anyway. So you're not gaining anything out of your pocket. It's just taking it out of one pocket and putting it in the other. So that's kind of a non-starter. Again, the real problem with what has happened here was the Liberals oversold this as this is our kind of solution to all this. They can't solve it. The all thing is government can't solve it. GST, you're right, that is something they could go for. That would probably give some short-term relief. The problem with this one is there are some things that government just can't solve. And this one, the causes of what's going on in people's family budgets is beyond the reach of this government or any government.
Okay, so I'm going to go a little bit on another topic here, Adrian. Minister Freeland said undermining institutions like the Bank of Canada during an era of economic volatility was, quote, highly irresponsible and economically illiterate. Was she throwing shade on conservative leadership candidate Pierre Poilievre, maybe?
I think so. I think so. I mean, Pierre Poilievre has thrown a lot of shade to her. So I guess a little bit of tit for tat in that regard. I think that there is certainly concerns amongst Liberals about who is going to ultimately win in the Conservative leadership. But realistically, Joyce, you know, Minister Freeland's speech, it just seemed like a giant distraction. And look, I agree with Greg Weston. Canadians don't expect government to solve their problems. In fact, they're usually the cause of many of Canadians' problems. But her speech just seemed more like a distraction from all those other wait lists that are happening out there and for all the other incompetent acts of the a number of cabinet ministers over the past few weeks. If it's parting with Russian diplomats or lineups at the passport office or ridiculous lineups at the airport. These are all distractions from the very real, tangible issues that Canadians are dealing with every day, the cost of inflation. I don't think that government is going to be able to be the solution to this. They're not. But there are certainly steps that they can take within a certain public policy act they can take to mitigate some of that. And it's not spending. It is revisiting the tax system. But, going after conservative leadership candidates in your so-called save the economy speech helps nobody.
Maybe she felt she owed it to him, but and
maybe
speaking of solutions, some of these measures are medium to long term solution. You know, was it a mistake not to introduce immediate measures? And let me ask you, can the government really help that much in a situation like this?
Yes, it was a mistake to focus primarily on medium to long-term issues because there are some immediate things that can and should be done. There have been lots of really good suggestions. One is this tax on the excess profits and redistributing that money through the GST rebate or through the Canada Child Tax Benefit. I mean, there are things that the government can do and should do right now to address this. I agree that that they can't solve it, but they can certainly help right now. And, you talked earlier about immigration, that backlog and all of those kinds of things. I don't know if anybody else remembers, but I remember the watchword at the beginning of this government back in 2015 was something called deliverology. And if you look at this government over the years since then, one of the key problems that exist is the problem of implementation. So, we have a big backlog, whether it's in immigration or passports or airport lineups or all of the kinds of things that we know. I think there needs to be a focus on actually getting things done and helping people now.
I think that's what deliverology means, isn't it? Yes, I remember that word. That word, I remember we tried to find the definition of it back then. Greg McCachran, Adrian Bhatia, Anne McGrath. No, we didn't. Anne McGrath and Greg Weston, thank you again for being there. Have yourselves a wonderful and safe weekend. And coming up, it is Friday, which means the wonderful Rachel and Susan are here with their political plays and misplays of the week. Here they are. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And welcome back. We are officially in what's known in circles here on Parliament Hill as silly season on Parliament Hill. It's the final race to pass legislation and wrap up committee work before MPs leave Ottawa for the summer. So, did anyone pull off a win in the last dash to get through these last House working days? Well, let's bring in the press gallery with their political plays and misplays of the week. We've got must-read Toronto Star columnist Susan Delacourt and CTV's online political producer Rachel Aiello. She writes the Capital Dispatch newsletter. It's another must-read. Welcome to you both. Happy Friday. Good to see you. So, Susan, I'm going to start with you with your pick. You're handing out a misplay.
Too many people. I think we've talked on this show before about how the government and particularly the public safety minister, Marco Mendicino, have kind of been unclear on the reasons for the declaration of the emergency or bringing in of the emergency legislation. This week, Mr. Mendicino had many friends trying to help him. I've counted now Bill Blair, the deputy minister, Chrystia Freeland, and none other than the prime minister, and nobody has helped. They are treating this as a communications exercise. They are doubling and stumbling over each other, and they have now talked themselves into a corner where I think they always had to release some measure of the cabinet deliberations on this, but they have left themselves now no option on this. This has just been a communications mess. I'm sorry to say that. It's too important to have become a communications mess, and now there is a huge amount of pressure on the formal inquiry, which will get started sort of in the summer, to get to the bottom of this. But they have not proven that they can handle this on their own. They're going to have to release something a little more substantial.
Or call a few grown-ups maybe, but it is interesting because he says, the minister said, the police asked us, they said they needed the Emergencies Act to do their job. The police say, no, we didn't. So what kind of conversations may the minister have had? Is he in trouble or is the whole government in trouble over this? Susan.
I want to say, look, we're journalists. We're supposed to stay in the middle. And I actually do see what they're trying to say. And there is a middle story on this. In a functioning, non-authoritarian regime, the police don't tell the government what to do and the government doesn't tell the police what to do. I get that. That's what they have been trying to say all along. The police didn't tell the government to do this, and the government didn't tell the police what to do. Rather than say that, though, we have been dancing on the head of a pin now for forever. I think it would have been really easy to say, we talked to the police, they needed the tools, it was a political decision, we made it. And point for now. Rather than that, though, they just keep surrounding all their justifications for this in communications ease, like they're reading some manual on how to say this. Just tell us in plain language, you didn't take orders from the police, we didn't give orders to the police, but there was a conversation about how to best do that. I get that. That's not what they've said.
Not at all. Rachel, ultimately, we're just a week away from summer. They are going to rise and go home. So will this stick to the government?
I think it will. And just keep in mind, the policing part of this conversation is only one part of it. There's the financial stuff. There's, to a certain degree, the strain on Ottawa residents that are also factors in why they enacted this. So it's a bit interesting that we're hung up on this one specific element. But keep in mind, this national inquiry is going to be going on until 2023. So while they may get a couple months of reprieve from daily questions and question period, this overall topic is not going away. There's still going to be more discoveries, more questions made, more opportunities for them to do, as Susan is suggesting, and be more candid and transparent about what went into this. They've defended this up and down. They've said they want to be open about it, and they feel strongly about why they enacted the Emergencies Act. So I think they have to show it.
I think it's interesting because you always wonder, is it just us on the Hill who care about this and who are making a big deal, and the opposition, of course, who's trying to score political points, and rightly so. That's what they do. That's their job, is to hold the government accountable. But out there, outside of the of Parliament Hill, outside of the bubble, are people really caring about who asked for what? The problem was fixed, and most people have moved on, or not?
I think from my perspective. Go ahead, Rachel.
Go ahead, Susan.
We're having a Canadian polite off. I didn't ask Rachel to do that, and Rachel didn't ask me. Yes, I think it's important. I don't know that Canadians are all caught up in the jurisdictional wars of all of this. Then, like Rachel said, they just wanted it fixed. I do think, though, it's an important discussion, especially we're hearing about, you know, future protests, what Canada Day is going to be like here. It is an important discussion. It, as I said, too important to be left to a communications muddle.
Absolutely. And a historic
one.
Bank accounts were frozen. But Rachel, I need to get to your pick because I think you also have a misplay.
I do. I'm giving my misplay this week to the federal government's announcement that they are lifting vaccine mandates without coming forward with a concrete plan to address what's going on at the border. No movement on reentry requirements, for example. So, you know, the government has been under pressure for a few weeks to resolve what's going on at airports and at the border. And I was a bit surprised to see them announce this week that they are now willing to let millions more Canadians travel. Having personally recently experienced what it's like to travel internationally in this country, I've seen firsthand how this patchwork of border measures and COVID measures are supposed to work. And I think the big takeaway for me is that having all of these measures in place is only as good as the enforcement of them. And if one of the major issues is staffing and not having the people to follow up, then what is the point of putting the ArriveCan app out there, making sure these measures are being followed? So it's going to be interesting to watch how they try to navigate now this influx of folks at the airports, which the government has acknowledged is going to happen. This wasn't their attempt to fix things. But this group of people who are coming now will be able to travel. The unvaccinated population are still going to have to quarantine. And my impression is throughout the pandemic, they didn't really have the staff to follow up and ensure that quarantines were happening. So now with the staffing crunch and a bunch more people traveling, I guess we're all just going to equally be able to experience the like unfortunate time at an airport. And the government's just hoping that everyone's excitement to be able to travel again is going to overshadow the experience they had waiting for hours in line.
Susan, I have 30 seconds. The ArriveCan app, is it here or is it going? Are they keeping it? 30 seconds.
If they're keeping it, they should not. The concerns about it are real, and those mayors who spoke up about it this week are credible voices on this. I think it's time to move on from the app.
Susan and Rachel, as usual, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Yes, there will be longer lineups at airports, maybe, so brace yourself if you're traveling. Thanks for being on the show, and that is your Power Play Day in Politics. Thanks for watching. We will be back on Monday, same time, same place. Have yourselves a wonderful weekend.